Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Matthew Scheuchat and Ricky Gurwitz. We talk about their new film, The Accountant of Auschwitz. This is one of those documentaries that I think everyone needs to watch more documentaries, and you probably know that by now if you've been listening to Face to Face for a little while. But this is one of those that everybody needs to see. There's so much going on here, way more going on than meets the eye. This is a film, it's one of those films that's about a little bit about everything. And we get into, of course, World War II and the Nazism and ideology and the banality of evil. We talk about, you know, being a small cog in a very big machine. We talk about forgiveness and the a moral versus a legal distinction about being convicted and about guilt and about responsibility and what complicity actually means and what does it mean to us today. And Matthew and Ricky tell this story in such a beautiful and a compelling way that you come away, I think, with some answers. But you are also left with a lot of questions about what's next. Is this going to happen again? Can we talk about legal precedents for the future? What does it mean to be indifferent and to turn a blind eye? What is it? What is and hate as a powerful weapon? We look into the social media that is all, you know, at our fingertips, or we turn on the news and we can see that hate truly is a powerful weapon. Stay tuned. You are going to love this interview. It's coming right up. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more information about my speaking and writing, and also facetofacelive.ca for a whole lot of other interviews, and we've got a lot of interviews recently from Hot Docs this year and a lot of documentaries that you're going to want to get out and see. But coming up right now, Matthew Scheuchat, Ricky Gurwitz, talking about their new film, The Accountant of Auschwitz.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by two very special guests here, two Hot Docs guests here with us today, Matthew Scheuchat and Ricky Gurwitz, here to talk about their new film, The Accountant of Auschwitz. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about maybe the buzz that you're feeling as we as you guys are about to launch into Hot Docs. You starting to feel a little bit of that energy?
Well, we're definitely very excited. Firstly, because we're both local. We're from Toronto, so to have it premiere at any festival in Toronto would be exciting. Let alone the Hot Docs International Documentary Film Festival, which is like the biggest in North America, second biggest of its kind in the world. So it's like really exciting. And yeah, the three screenings that we have, they went rush very quickly. So a lot of people bought tickets and are very excited for the film. So we're definitely very excited.
Yeah, that's it's amazing. Well, let me say congratulations right out of the gate, because I have seen the film, and as I just mentioned to you before we plunged into the recording of our conversation, I've seen a lot of doc film in the last 4 or 5 years, the last 25 years, I suppose, but specifically with regard to Face to Face, and I took just a slew of notes. I just didn't know where to stop. It was just so engaging and interesting and frankly disturbing.
I don't know if that's what we were going
that's
for.
That's right. Well, hold on. Well, I'll tell you what, though. Let's dive right in with a question. I mean, it sure doesn't feel like a disturbing movie. If you were to close your eyes and just listen to the soundtrack as the establishing shots are sort of appearing on the screen, you know, and some of the quotes about what we're about to dive into just make it feel as if it almost like a circus feel.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wanted to choose those lines. It's because, you know, for people who haven't seen it, it's shocking to hear that Auschwitz said it, talked about in this way. And we thought it was important to show that if you weren't Jewish, Auschwitz wasn't a death camp.
Right.
And that you can actually have a positive experience there, which is quite shocking.
Yeah, a sports club, canteen.
Oh, you're referring to the opening sequence.
Yeah, the opening sequence. I mean, it's almost absurd.
Yeah, knowing quotes from the accountant recalling the good times. You know, as an SS officer or an SS guard who worked in Auschwitz-Birkenau, he's kind of recalling, you know, the friends he made there, and there was drinking and there was a cinema. You know, so it's the complete opposite of what you would have been taught in school or seen in film.
Sure. Yeah, the juxtaposition of some of the images, I mean, the one that stands out in my mind right now is the shot of the chef, you know, kind of we don't typically talk about the banality of evil, right? I mean, it just presents it in a whole new way.
And really that's the point of the film is, you know, Hannah Arendt, referenced with the banality of evil, right? That was her saying.
Yes.
And of course, that was completely criticized when she first came out saying that after the Eichmann trial. And she was talking in reference to Adolf Eichmann, who was the mastermind of the Final Solution of the Holocaust, and he was put on trial. And she said that he was like a normal human being who did bad things, right? And of course, it's horrified people because the idea that this person was normal was not acceptable. And our film is about this man who wasn't the architect of the Holocaust. He was a very small cog in a very big killing machine, but he helped to make it run.
Mm.
And it was the groaning. It was the Oscar groanings of Germany that allowed the Holocaust to happen, not the few top people like Adolf Eichmann who gave the orders. It was the cogs who ran the machine.
At some point in the film, I forget who it was, but talked about the guards, and I think it was Eli, one of the lawyers, who had this great analogy about somebody.
Yep.
Running around in his room with a knife, and if there was somebody standing outside holding the door, they would be, you know, probably convicted of murder, of first degree murder,
yeah.
You know, in the U.S. Whereas you've got this hundreds of thousands of people who were largely complicit, and you guys are pretty much saying ultimately also responsible, are you not?
Well, in a certain sense, we're saying that everyone has a share of the responsibility.
Yeah.
Like that, the quote you're referring to is from Eli Rosenbaum, who worked at the Department of Justice, the Office of Special Investigations in Washington. You know, he's actually one of the biggest quote unquote Nazi hunters, but he doesn't get a lot of like fame for the amazing work that he's done.
Right.
But you know, you have the big killers and the people who organized the Holocaust and all the atrocities in the Second World War, who a lot of them escaped into South America, into other countries, and they lived in hiding. Then you have all these people, like what Ricky was just speaking about, these small cogs that made it happen, hundreds of thousands of them who just went back to their lives. The chef at Auschwitz, the accountant at Auschwitz, you know, the one who's cleaning the floors of the gas chambers after the bodies are taken out. Like, they went back to their old jobs, and there was just so much injustice after the war, which is a very interesting and shocking part of the film. We find, and we definitely think the audience will find as well, when you really learn these staggering numbers, that from like 800,000 SS officers at the end of the war, only 124 ever received a life sentence.
Yeah, what was it, 100,000 investigated, and then
6,200 were on trial.
And 124 convicted. I mean, this is, it's outrageous. There was another lawyer you interview at some point, is it Dershowitz? And he talks about Groening being a symbol. And he said that the real issue is what happened after the war.
And what happened after the war, he says, was disgraceful. Because remember, all these people we're talking about now, these 100,000, they're not hiding.
Right.
You know,
right.
When I start to talk, sometimes when we tell people about the film, they're like, oh, how did they catch him? Where was the accountant hiding?
Right.
He wasn't hiding.
Right.
They would never have been seen as being complicit because they never really went after guards. There was a whole change in the legal thinking of Germany just under 10 years ago with the John Demjanjuk trial. Where before that, you had to have specific evidence that someone had either the will, the political will to kill someone, or the you know they were driven by racial means, or you know there's so many reasons why people weren't on trial at that time, and they lived their normal lives. They lived happy lives.
And one of the things that, just to build on that point, I mean, it's Germany in a sense was put in a very abnormal position after the war. What do you do when so many of your countrymen participate in a crime on such a large scale, right? In a war crime, and do you prosecute 800,000 men? Do you send 800,000 men to prison in a country already ravaged by war, who've lost so much of their population to fighting in that war? So where do you draw the line?
Right.
And for various political reasons, Germany decided to draw the line at the higher-ups, the very higher-ups. And even those very higher-ups only got pitiful sentences.
Well,
3 years, 5 years, 7 years for killing 90,000 people.
And help me out here. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there another comment about 22 people because there was 22 seats? I mean, that was Nuremberg, was it not?
Yeah, so that was Benjamin Ferenc, who's an amazing, amazing man.
Incredible.
He's so great.
He's 98 years old.
He's the kind of guy you just kind of want to reach in and give him a hug or shake his hand.
Well, that's exactly how Ricky and I felt when we went to his...
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. Florida. He's amazing.
And so he was one of the first, if not the first, war crimes investigator, right, from the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. And so he fought against the... He has an amazing story which deserves a movie in of itself.
Right, bet he does.
The first time he ever stepped foot in a courtroom was in Nuremberg. He was a recent graduate of Harvard Law. He went to fight the war. He was at 27 years
27.
Old, and he found these secret documents of the Einsatzgruppen who killed 1.1 million people. And he said, you have to prosecute them. And they said, well, we have no one to prosecute. Will you do it? And he said, okay. So he sits and he goes, you know, into a courtroom facing 22 of the worst murderers that have ever, you know, committed atrocities, and he, you know, puts them on trial. It's an amazing, amazing thing, but at the same time, it was very interesting what he says, which is that there were 3,000 of these men who killed 1.1 million people, and he could only put 22 people on trial because that's how many seats were in the dock, which means that 2,000, you know, 900 and whatever it was, my math is terrible, but they, all those other men who killed 1.1 million people were never prosecuted.
These are like, remember, this is the Einsatzgruppen. These are the death battalions. These aren't, this is an Oscar Groening counting some suitcase, stuff taken from suitcases. These are people who are going into the town. This is before they establish Treblinka, Sobibor, all these death camps. They're going into the towns and they're executing anyone who's Jewish. They're taking it. These are the stories you hear, like the film Defiance with Daniel Craig, you know, going into the forest, they're just shooting right. everyone in the head right. in mass pits. That's how over a million people were killed. And then they did gas chambers and stuff like that because it was too expensive. Bullet-wise, it was messing with the soldiers' heads. But each of these people, each of these 3,000 men, were shooting men, women, children, one shot at a time into pits. So these thousands of other people who weren't included in the 22 seats in the dock, they went back to their lives as well.
Yeah, right. No, it's remarkable. I'd never heard that 22 number before. That is for sure.
We felt the same way when he said that. Ricky and I were like, is that a joke? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Really? Did that's the reason?
Did I hear him right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the thing about this movie is that, you know, there's been a lot of movies about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And this movie, we were interested in making it because there was so much we learned that we thought we knew and we really didn't. And we learned so much, and especially about after the war. You know, this film is not a film about the Holocaust. It's about how Germany
yeah.
and the world
yeah.
prosecuted the criminals that were involved.
Well, I love that you said that, Ricky, because it seems to me that any great film or any great doc is obviously it's about what you're seeing on screen. It's about the content. It's about the subject. But it usually dives way deeper than that. And this is a film about responsibility and choice and complicity and evil. And I mean, I love too the way you bring Peter Singer into it. You know, are you still punishing the man who did the crime in the first place?
Club.
What a great question, right? What an important question.
Right.
And chilling. It's chilling to think about it. But maybe it's true. You know, like that's one of the things that when Ricky came to me with the idea, she was saying there's just so many challenging questions. Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to think. Every day I'm going back and forth on how I think about these issues and about Oscar Gronin and himself, you know.
It's fascinating to me that it's as if he, I mean, do you get the sense after having studied this and researched it and filmed this film, do you get the sense that this was his way of seeking some kind of absolution? I mean, he seems to ask for forgiveness, or in fact, I think he does ask for forgiveness, or at least you show in the film. Doesn't do a jail sentence, but is convicted. Is he coming to terms with that? I mean, he's one of the first guys to have it admitted, right? That
he speaks in the courtroom.
That's
like,
right.
Never, ever happens. But
that's
remember,
right.
the reason, not the main reason, but one of the reasons why he was put under the spotlight after the whole legal thinking change and the precedent with John Demjanjuk in 2010, Oscar Gronin, 5 years before in 2005, willingly gave an interview for the BBC in Der Spiegel magazine in Germany. And, you know, he was just a guard. We were not put on trial, and he spoke about the things that he saw. And also in the 1980s, he was at a stamp collection club and people were denying the Holocaust. And he said, I was there. I saw the gas chambers. I saw the burning pits. And he wrote letters to Holocaust denier printings. And so that can be seen as a form of some sort of redemption.
Mm.
Was
right.
he doing that personally? Was he doing that to show the world? Like there's many ways, I guess we'll never really know.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. It also brings up another philosophical point, which is Gronin's good deed, in a sense, standing up to Holocaust deniers,
yeah.
making this all known so that, you know, they can't view their hateful rhetoric. Does his good deed later in life absolve him of the bad deed he was complicit in 1944?
Right.
How do we square that circle? How do we understand those two things side by side? And you know, I think a case could be made for both.
Yeah, I think so too, and I think it's really I love too how and so important that you brought the question of forgiveness into the film and Eva's story and
yeah.
and the what an image of her embracing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's chilling. I mean, there's so many, actually quite a few chilling moments in the film for me. I mean, and remarkable too, that you were able to interview Rudolf Hess. Is that his name? His grandson, Rainer?
Rainer Hess. Yeah.
Huss,
it's pronounced.
Huss. Is that a great grandson?
That's his grandson.
Grandson. And so he even says, I can't forgive, but if Eva has to, in order to move on, okay, I'm okay
yeah.
with it.
Which one of the lawyers said as well, like, she's a victim just like any other survivor.
Yeah. yeah.
She was a Mengele twin. She's been tortured. Her whole family was wiped out. So obviously she has the right,
right,
to forgive if it does something for her. But the question is, was that the proper place to do it?
Right.
You know, she went there as a witness testifying against him. And then she announces that, I forgive you. She was doing it for herself. She wasn't doing it on behalf of survivors, but the way how it erupted into the media,
right,
people were kind of questioning, like, well, what was her motive? And do they think that now all the survivors forgive all the Nazis? And these were kind of the headlines,
sure,
that were coming out of the trial, not the fact that he's actually spoken about what he's seen in Auschwitz. It's more about he's been forgiven by a Jewish survivor. So that was very interesting.
Well,
which, yeah, we definitely wanted to bring into the film, for,
well,
sure.
And I'd love to hear your thoughts on forgiveness too. I mean, and after seeing the images you've seen, and you must have gone pretty deep, into the story and the stuff that you didn't show us, right? And, mm-hmm, and Ricky, what you said about how much you've learned. I mean, do you walk away from this going, we're all screwed?
Mm.
Or you know what? No, there is redemption. There, people can reconcile. People can forgive.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
It's a great question.
God. You know, I like I said, one of the reasons I originally wanted to do this film was because I really couldn't pick one way. I couldn't pick a side.
Right.
If that's the best way to describe it.
Right.
I really, one day I thought, oh my God, he's totally complicit. The next day I thought, no, he's changed. He's a changed man. And, you know, he was just one of 800,000. Like, how many, you know? So he's the last one left alive, and we're going to convict him because everyone else died, you know? Like, it seemed absurd to me.
Yep.
But the more I did this film, the more into it I got, and the more footage I saw of the camp and of Auschwitz, I'm more leaning towards the fact that he is guilty.
Right.
And the reason for that is because you just, if you stepped foot in that camp, you knew what was going on. It wasn't, oh, I was on the ramp, and therefore, you know, I saw them being selected. If you stepped foot anywhere near that vicinity, you could smell the stench of death.
Mm,
you could,
yeah,
see the bodies lying everywhere. And if you see that and don't do anything, you're complicit. And in my mind, just because everyone else died off and just because the law didn't catch up with the rest of them doesn't mean that he shouldn't be punished.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think it's important for us to use that way of thinking for how we view war crimes that are currently taking place, because, again, we are saying if you're there and you know what's happening, you're complicit. And how often in this world today do we see war crimes taking place? And we know, I mean, we have the internet, we have TV now, we know,
yeah,
what's happening in Syria, and we are doing nothing. So
yeah,
my hope is that this verdict and this trial and this film, for that matter, will help us understand our own complicity and responsibility in war crimes that are taking place in modern times.
Well, and at near the end of the film, again, is it another lawyer, I think, who says that this whole idea of the phrase, never again, right? I mean, this is...
Yeah, that's Ephraim Zuroff. He's the head of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem.
Doesn't he say it completely meaningless?
Yeah. He said again and again and again, these atrocities keep happening. And maybe it can send a powerful message, because unfortunately it keeps happening. And as Ricky said, with the internet and like everything that we're exposed to in 2018, and the most that people do in terms of people I know is like they'll change their Facebook profile picture to like a tinted flag of the country where like 100 people were just murdered.
Well, this
or Syria, where half a million people have been murdered in the last 5 years.
And we call that public engagement. Right. If I forward
the picture of a candle.
Yeah, yeah, and then I tweet it and I retweet it and then I like it. That I'm now engaged.
But that's like from the audience perspective of people watching war crimes happen, and then. But what Dershowitz also says in that same section is this can hopefully deter others. You know, if even at the end of your life, justice will catch up with you. You know, some people might agree with that.
Right.
Some people might not. Like, it's not in the film, but we have, when we were interviewing Peter Singer, he said, I really wonder if it would really deter someone. Mm. You know, well, if I'm going to live till 95, what do I care? But maybe not. You know, so there's so many questions about the whole film.
There really is, and something I'd love to talk about in a second, if you're in, is this moral legal distinction that even Oscar brings up at the end. You put into the film this idea that I'm morally guilty, but I'll leave it up to you to decide whether or not I'm legally guilty.
Such a strange thing to say.
It's pretty strange. Yeah. So clearly he's convicted about something, but maybe just still self-protective on a whole other level. I'm not really quite sure what it all means. But this idea, this ideological, you bring it out right out of the gate, this idea that, you know, we've got a canteen and a cinema, and this is just life for us. And we knew this, he talked about that we were the direct, I'm not going to get the direct quote, but we were convinced by our worldview that everyone was out to get us, that the Jews were out to get us.
Yeah.
And so if you're raised this way, and I mean, there are parallels to what's going on everywhere pretty much in the world today, right?
Right. And that's something we wanted to get the audience to ask for them, to ask is, what would I have done?
Right. Yeah.
You know, had we all been growing up in a nationalist socialist house with a, you know, joining Hitler Youth and being brainwashed at a young age, like, this is all we know. At what point are you in, do you have the free thought and independent thought enough to say no? And the strength to do that in a country where everyone is following, you know, one way of thought.
Right.
So is it expecting too much from him? And again, we can see that around the world. I mean, when you look at, you know, people who are engaged in radical terror and ISIS, right? And from a young age, they're brought up in extremist households. And later on, they commit crimes. You know, how responsible are they?
It's being ingrained in children's minds when they're at that age, when everything will affect the person that they become. Like, if you look at the way that children are educated under Hamas, it's like, it's scary. And ISIS, you know, so there's all these parallels that you can use, which is one of the reasons why, you know, Holocaust education, I think, is so important, because it can relate to so many things that are happening now, and not just now, with anything that's happened after 1945. There's so many atrocities, and how can we prevent it? And, you know, but then what Dershowitz says is, even if you're brainwashed, you have to, something needs to click in your mind when you see a baby being smashed, or you see someone being shot in the head, you must know, like, that's obviously not right, but who knows, you know? If they really thought that they were the cause of World War One and all the problems, and this was war and it had to be done. Like, there's all these types of quotes that we explore throughout the film.
So there's a great line in the film, and I don't know who it is that said it, but somebody said hate is a powerful weapon, and I'm just reminded of Elie Wiesel's quote about, you know, the opposite of hate is or love is not hate, it's indifference. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, that complicity, the responsibility and choice. I mean, is that whole idea of turning a blind eye and saying, yeah, I know it's wrong, but I'm indifferent to it, so I'm just going to walk the other way. I mean, is that, do you come out of this film thinking that's the big problem? That's the root of all evil?
Isn't there a great line? I mean, this isn't from our film. This is a very famous line. The way for bad people to do bad things is for indifferent people to do nothing, right? And I'm definitely messing it up, but it's something along those lines. And again, I think that comes down to the question of how we view complicity and responsibility, and where we draw the line, right? I mean, the people in Auschwitz, obviously, we believe that they had some responsibility, but, you know, the people in Germany who weren't killing anyone, but, I mean, they did see Jews being taken off trains and
their neighbors
by police.
That's
and
right.
Saw their possessions being carted off, and, I mean, are they complicit? Where do you draw the line? And there has to be a point. A whole country can't be in jail. It can't go on.
Just to sort of riff off of that a little bit, the deniers too that you bring into the, you guys bring in so much, and you do it so beautifully, by the way. But the Holocaust deniers, the interview where, I don't know, older woman and a police officer,
Ursula Haverbeck.
Yeah, and the police officer.
Nazi grandmother, that's her name in the media.
Sorry, what's her name? Not the Nazi.
They've labeled her the Nazi grandmother. You know how in Germany it's illegal, it's against the law. The Holocaust deny and you can go to jail, which I find very interesting in terms of freedom of speech, but that's another story.
Well, it's just remarkable to me how the police officer actually shut the conversation down, shut the interview down.
Yeah. And now she was on trial a few months ago, and she's actually, I'm not sure if she's in jail now, but she was found guilty because of what she was doing at Groening's trial and one of these other trials that we mentioned that have happened because of his trial. She goes there, she hands out papers, full denying, like, the Holocaust, and she's very famous, and I think she was found guilty. She's supposed to be in jail. I think she's 89 or 90 years old.
Wow. So is it, you know, you guys talk a lot about, I mean, you can't watch this film and not think about the future. Any of my listeners will know, and I'd love to chat with you guys offline about this at some point, but I've been working in Cambodia since about 2003, and the Khmer Rouge and the trials are still going on and the atrocities that were committed there. And I mean, that's, you know, and you got Rwanda and so on. As you can't watch this film and not think about the future. Have the precedents been set? You know, I mean, you talk about it in the film. Some of the lawyers that you interview certainly bring it up. We talk about this idea of never again and learning from our past. Oh, I've got this quote I have to read that was just without history, there is no memory. Without memory, there is no future. I mean, it's just so beautiful and so perfect. Yeah. So are you guys hopeful? There's a lot in that, but are you hopeful?
It's a tough question.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Where are we headed?
Yeah, it's like you get hopeful, and then all of a sudden you hear something horrible has happened, and someone's driving over people with their van.
Yeah,
and this, and again, no matter what the motive is, like, you're just surrounded by all these horrible things that happen: school shootings, or terrorist attacks, or war. You know, it's crazy, and it's hard to stay determined. But when Ricky and I were interviewing Benjamin Ferenz, you know, the 98-year-old, he's the last surviving prosecutor for Nuremberg. He's very hopeful. And he says, we're always going up. And then we come, we spiral down a bit, something bad happens, and then we go a bit higher, and we come back down, but always going a bit higher in terms of, we're going to make a difference, we're going to get there.
Right.
You know, he helped establish the International Criminal Court. He's very optimistic, even though there's so much evil and horrible things that still happen in the world. He does feel that we're ultimately heading in hopefully a positive direction, which is nice to feel. So I
have a bit of a different take. I think that I don't believe that the trial of Oscar Groening will prevent a war criminal in Sierra Leone, child soldier from committing an act of killing. I don't believe that. I think if anything, they'll say, well, like, this guy's 94 years old. I have the rest of my life. No one cares about me.
Right.
But I do think that his trial can serve to do several other things. One is which teach valuable history lesson to kids today who might not be as interested in World War II and the Holocaust as their parents and grandparents were, and it kind of brings it into a more modern perspective. And the other thing is, I think that people, ordinary people, I'm not talking about the child soldiers or the war criminals or the ISIS, I'm talking about the everyday, normal human being who sees what goes on, perhaps they will ask themselves, well, am I complicit?
Yeah,
and if I am, what can I do?
What can I do?
And I hope that is the kind of message that this film, passes on to its viewers.
Yeah.
That's what I love. I love about there's this strong existential sort of component to the whole film. You know, because it really is about choice, right? That whole idea of indifference and turning the other way and responsibility, and it's all tied into becoming a better human, but also becoming, I guess, more authentic and more truthful, more transparent, I suppose. I mean, it's just it's so many of these things that you guys touch on in the film. I just so love. Can we talk about just before? Sadly, we're going to have to wrap up here in a few minutes. But one of the men who you dedicate the film to, I think at the end, Bill Gleed. Yeah, Bill Gleed. There's a scene, and I think it's just maybe a perfect way to kind of wrap up the conversation. But Ricky, you had mentioned you learned so much, and I wanted to say when you had talked about that, and as you guys were making this film, I just the power of story, right? The power of individual story. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I love film, why I love fiction. But doc film, it takes on a whole other sort of a life of its own, it seems to me, this idea of narrative and history and story and the future and so on. But when he was flipping through, and I don't even know what it is, but it looked like one big, massive book of names.
So that... finish what you were going to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say this, the power of that, you know, as you would, the font, the print, the magnitude, all at once, you know? And again, the power of the individual.
Yeah. So that's actually in Auschwitz One. There are three sections of Auschwitz. There's Auschwitz One, which has the famous sign when you walk in, "Work will make you free,"
right.
"Arbeit macht frei." And then there's Auschwitz Two, Birkenau. The trains would come in where we kind of focus in the film, because that's where the main gas chambers and crematory were. And then there was another one called Monowitz. And you know, it's all basically there, but there's certain blocks that they've turned into museums. So you go into one and there's like the pile of hair and glasses and prosthetics. And then this is a new part of the museum that was funded by Yad Vashem. Basically a massive book. There's 4 million names in that book of people that they've confirmed that they know were murdered. 4 million people from the Holocaust. And we were filming with Bill. We were there for 2 days in Auschwitz and Auschwitz-Birkenau, and we went into this room. He had never been there before, and we follow him as he goes to the G section. He's from Yugoslavia, and his mother, I think, was Hungarian, but it was a part of the Hungarian Empire. And he finds pages and pages of Gleed. You know, we filmed him for longer than you see in the film, but he found so many other people. But he found there's my mom, there's my sister, there's my dad.
And I think one of the reasons that scene is so powerful is because oftentimes we talk about the Holocaust in broad numbers, you know, 6 million, 1.1 million, 900,000. But this scene, you're actually seeing individual names and how many there are. And just think of that one page, and that's a tiny fraction of the people who were killed. So it really kind of puts it into perspective.
Yeah, it truly is mind-boggling. Thank you for joining me today, talking with Matthew Scheuchat and Ricky Gerwitz about their new film, The Accountant of Auschwitz. And again, congratulations on the film, and I wish you well at Hot Docs. I hope everyone sees it. It's a brilliant film. It's an important
film. Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate your time today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.